Hey there, conductors. If you've ever felt that you're not quite sure what to do next when you're studying a score, maybe you don't even know where to start with a difficult piece, maybe you study one piece too much and then you realize at the first rehearsal that you don't know another one well enough, or maybe you're a new conductor and you don't know what score study is, I'm excited to share that I'm finally publishing and sharing my score study checklist. I've been refining this for 12 years now, and I'm so excited to share it. It is going to walk you through my structure, my process to make sure that I learn every score that I need to learn well enough and so that nothing falls through the cracks. So it covers everything that you need to know. There's a link in the show notes. Go ahead and click it, sign up, and you'll get that score study checklist sent right to your email. You'll also get access to an 8-minute video of me explaining what each section is and how I use it to organize all the music that I need to learn. It's only 8 minutes, so it's not going to take you a whole hour to learn how to study better, how to put up a process for your score study, and how to make sure that nothing is falling through the cracks. So again, click the link in the show notes, and I hope to see you soon. Now, please enjoy this episode of Podium Time. Welcome to Podium Time, the podcast for conductors and students.
Everything is about conviction. I mean, if you don't have your ideas, your own ideas, and you don't defend your own statements, then what's the point of you being a conductor? If you're conducting Shostakovich, then you're going to represent Shostakovich's music. But there's something to be said, something magical about the idea that you are conducting right now. I mean, it's your interpretation of Shostakovich's music, and there's only going to be that one connection on planet Earth.
Stubborn people who think they're conductors and just want to try and change things in the middle of your performance, but that's cool.
Are you talking about me, Luke?
Oh wait, did you do that at my recital? I feel like we had something like that happen.
No, but I did sing at your recital.
That's because you had to.
I had to sing because our violinist didn't come in at the right time. So I had to sing her part. She didn't figure out where we were.
So we did the 23rd piano concerto. And the second movement, the violin comes in like with this like, dee-da-da-dee-da. And she just didn't come in. And so, like, Jeremy, like, in the recording, you could hear Jeremy, like, all this, like, you get his voice just crying over, like, and then she, like, kind of comes in.
she was just, like, sitting there, like, she had totally spaced out. She had no idea what was going on.
That's
I know exactly what you're talking about. It's like after the piano plays like 30 measures and then the orchestra has to come in cold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of an awkward
entrance. Yeah.
Entrance, especially if you're not paying attention.
Right. I'm so glad that's on the tape.
Yeah, we got it. We're recording already.
I'm glad that Jeremy's singing is on that tape.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, the recital. I still haven't heard it, but yeah.
You never will.
I never will.
Was that Luke's recital, or what was the deal with that?
I was conducting on Luke's piano recital, yeah.
Got it.
Actually, I think I still have them on my Dropbox, because we recorded it with my camera, Luke.
Oh, God.
I'll put that in at the end of the episode.
For the day that I was there, I was super impressed by Dr. Zesterpil. And the Wind, both groups, but namely the Wind Ensemble. Like, I was pretty impressed. Like, wow, yes. This is cool stuff.
How did you find your way out to Missouri for that workshop?
How did I hear about the workshop, or how did I get there?
Oh, no, like, how did you hear about it?
You know Travis Cross? Do you know that name?
The percussionist?
No, he's a conductor. He's the band director at UCLA.
No, his name sounds familiar, but I don't think I know him.
And he's also a composer, but he's mostly known for being the director of bands at UCLA.
Okay.
He's a young guy. He's no more than 40 at all. And he's a super avid Facebook user and posting everything. Big advocate for, like, hey, this band workshop is going on this weekend and this band workshop. And so he posted it. I'm sure, like, I'm certain he's friends with Dr. Zasterville. Like, I'm sure they knew each other very well. And so he posted it. What?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, like, I'm sure they do, because it's something I'm always kind of jealous of. Like, the band world is so connected. You know, like, the orchestra world is connected, but the, you know, band conductors, they know everybody. They know everybody who teaches everywhere, even down to small things. I'm always really impressed by how well connected and friendly they all are with each other, you know?
Oh, the band world, the wind world is like a family. Like, I don't know much malicious and ill will that anyone talks about anybody else in the band world. It's always talking about, like, oh, this person's doing really good at this university, and this person's doing great, and they're going to Midwest, and did you hear that they did this? And everyone knows each other, and everyone's connected. And it's a really comfortable and pleasant environment to be in. I love it. I really do love it, even though I am going to orchestra.
Well, it's something that Dr. Kelton and I have talked about as far as, like, the orchestra world. We know people, but we don't really stay connected and in touch with what's going on outside of our little area. And
right.
So, something that he had proposed that I really think is a cool idea is, just having kind of like a retreat of some type for orchestral conductors of any, you know, community orchestras, high school orchestras, you know, just to come together and kind of get to know each other and then talk about things, talk about conducting, talk about music, all that stuff that, you know, we just don't really do. I think that's a super cool idea, and I would be totally game for that.
Well, one of the things that the band world has over the orchestra world is that they do the Midwest Clinic every December. I don't know. Do you know about that?
I don't.
So every December in Chicago, every year, it's always Chicago, and it falls around the same weekend every time. There's a clinic called a conference called the Midwest Clinic, where bands from all over the world come for this, of all ages. I mean, you have these Japanese bands of middle schoolers that are just arguably better than the U.S. Army bands, and or you have universities represented, Eastman or any of the Texas schools or whatever. They come and they give performances. And it's also for orchestra too, but I mean, it's so rare that orchestras are represented. It's usually wind ensembles, and I mean, anyone who is anyone in the band world goes to that thing every December. And so it's just an annual way to stay connected in the band world. And there's, of course, there's the exhibit hall that has, you know, that's where I got my three batons from. And there's the, you know, it has all the instrumental companies represented and sheet music and, you know, anything you could think of is there. And I just don't know anything in the orchestra world. It's, if anything, it's so competitive that you have people trying to, like, fight for a spot rather than join together as a community feel. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Like, I think something like that, I guess what I'm saying is, I think what you're saying, you're onto something. And if only the orchestra world had something like that yearly, and maybe they do that I don't know about. I don't know, but at least I don't hear about it like I do with the band world.
So. Well, I mean, we have, like, MMEA and stuff like that as far as, like, for educators, and I know that orchestra conductors do that, and that's band people and stuff. I went for the first time last year, so...
Right.
So there's that kind of stuff, but as far as, like, incorporating other, you know, everyone, not just educators, you know what I'm saying?
Right, I agree. Yeah, I agree completely. So anyway, we're all on the same track with that.
so that's how you found out about the
I found out on Facebook. I found out on Facebook because Travis Cross posted it, and I saw H. Robert Reynolds' name At the time, I didn't know your teacher, but I Googled him, and, you know, I was impressed, and I saw the rep that they had to offer. That was a huge one for me. When I saw the rep listed, I was like, man, and it was cheap, and I checked the plane tickets, and they were cheap at the time, so I figured, you know, I can't really lose. It's just the weekend. Like, why not, I guess? You know, I'm here alone in New York, and I'm just doing school, but other than school, I don't have any other jobs currently because my time is taken up with school. So I have time, is what I'm trying to say. So I just decided, why the heck not? Like, let's do it. So I emailed your teacher, and I submitted an application, and he emailed me back a day later. It was like, you got accepted, so on and so forth. Of course, I don't know if he rejected anybody, but, you know, anyway, I was accepted for what it's worth. And so I went, and it was just a really successful day.
So was Kelth teaching?
No.
No, okay.
It was just Dr. Zaspil.
I was going to give a shout-out to Podium Time Episode 6.
No, I mean, Dr. Kelth is my teacher. I don't study with Dr. Zaspil, so... He has helped me sometimes. Like, I've had him come in a few times and coach not only the horn ensemble but also me while I conduct them. And I've learned a lot every time he's done that. He's always, even though it's one of those, you know, conducting is conducting. It doesn't matter whether it's band or, you know, orchestra. You can still learn from any of it. And he always has something to say, and he knows exactly He references string playing a lot, which is, I think, is something that's interesting, given that he doesn't conduct string players. You know, I think he did that quite a bit at the workshop as well.
Quite a bit, which I was really grateful for, because a lot of wind conductors will forget, or maybe they don't forget, but they don't have it in their arm technique to kind of emulate the bow. And that's something that Farberman had been saying over and over again, is this idea of drawing the sound with you. You know, you're not just beating the points 1, 2, 3, 4, but it's the destination from 1 to 2, and how you're going to get from one place to the other with the sound wise. And string players actually have to do that to make their sound. You know, wind players, we do it with wind, and so it's, you don't actually see, You know what I'm talking about. You don't see the distance of the music being made physically. And so there were a lot of wind players there that day. Wind conductors there that were doing the whole beating 1, 2, 3, 4. And I'm not saying that they weren't expressive. They were very expressive, but it was difficult to see the motion of the sound. And so he referenced strings and having to draw the bow and stuff like that. And it really does help. So, yeah, he has a good point for bringing that stuff up, even in the wind world. And let me say one more thing, is that I keep making this differentiation between wind and orchestra world. And, I mean, there obviously is this huge one because the repertoire is so different and the culture is different and all this. But I was talking to Robert Reynolds about it. I asked him, you know, do you conduct orchestras ever? And that, now, in retrospect, that's such a... such a naive question. Of course he conducts orchestras, and that's exactly what he said. He said, of course I conduct orchestras. And he mentioned that, you know, it doesn't really matter. Like, this whole idea of being a band conductor and orchestral director, all it takes is a different skill set, but it doesn't mean, like, you have to find your place and dig your rut in one or the other. I mean, music is music. Musicianship is musicianship. And sound is sound, and that's never going to change. And so I think Dr. Zaspil, with good reason, makes references to string bowing, and I think orchestral directors should have their hand in wind conducting, because it's a totally new experience for them, and, yeah, and a good one. I'm blabbing about this, because it's something I'm passionate about. But anyway, I'm happy to be here with you guys. This is really exciting for me.
Oh, no. Well, we were just going to talk about, you know, the workshop, things you learned from it, and then, like, maybe talk a little bit about Bard, what it's like to study with Harold Farberman. He's a huge name in conducting.
Right.
So we reference him plenty on the podcast.
I know. So we haven't introduced you. This is Michael. Introduce yourself. What are you doing? You know, who are you?
Who am I? John Valjean. Anyway, little Lima's reference there. My name is Michael Patterson. I am a graduate student at Bard Conservatory in Annandale on Hudson, New York. That is a tiny little town that is 2 hours due north of Manhattan on the Hudson Valley, a much more beautiful part of New York than New York City ever will be. And yes, I said that on tape and I stand by it. Anyway, so I'm studying orchestral conducting, going for a master's, and I study with Harold Farberman, as you've said, and I'm enjoying my time here thoroughly. That's who I am and what I'm doing currently. And just in case you ask, I have mentioned wind conducting a lot. My instrument is the oboe, but that's actually my secondary. My primary instrument is the piano. I got my undergrad in that, and I consider myself a pianist through and through, but I've been playing oboe since in American education we have to pick in the fifth grade, do you want to sing in choir or play a band instrument? And heck no, I didn't want to sing. So I picked the oboe, and I've played that ever since.
Your degree was in piano performance?
Yep.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that.
Yep. I am a pianist. I say oboe a lot, but I am a pianist. And I've kind of given up on the oboe playing. I hate reed making. I hate it. And so anyone who listens to this that is a bassoon or oboe player, they will understand. And kudos to any of you who have done it as a major and continue, because I just don't have the patience for that.
You should have been a horn player.
No.
You could play the violin, too.
I'm actually taking violin lessons right now. You remember Erica?
Yes.
Yeah, so we have to here take either piano or string lessons. I didn't want to take piano lessons because, there's no benefit for learning something new in it for me. So I decided I'm going to take violin lessons. So she's my teacher. And I'm proud to say that I am learning about the third position.
Ooh, wow, wow, wow.
And my bowing sounds like chicken screeches, but, I'm having a good time.
That's okay. My bowing still sounds like chicken screeches.
I'm taking cello with the cello professor here, Dr. Murray, and yeah, I feel your pain as far as I have so much fun, but at the same time, like, I never, as a horn player, I always look at string players. I'm like, they just have to move their fingers really fast. How hard can it be?
Oh no.
But
oh,
then
no.
You realize like the fingers are only like 5% of it. And so like you've got the bow and the bow speed and the bow pressure and, all these little things, yeah, and placement and all these things add up to like what sound you want. And of course it's been good for me. I feel like any wind player who wants to be a conductor should definitely take a few years to learn a string instrument, because there's so much that I did not know and still don't know, that I'm still learning, that I think is definitely going to be helpful down the road. But I feel so bad. My dogs are literally scared of my cello. I think because of the noises that come out of it.
Man, I'm just waiting for the day that I can play vibrato, because like right now my tone is hideous, and I think it will be hideous for many, many years. And I just like, I really want to warm up the sound, but I can't because I have no idea how to do it. How do you guys do it? Jeremy, how do you do vibrato?
I don't know. Some programs have you like hold an egg shaker and just like shake it. I don't like.
Really?
I don't know. I learned it in like sixth grade, so I don't actually know how to explain it. It's kind of.
I'm gonna get an egg shaker now.
When I've taught my students, their hands are always too like stiff. It requires a very subtle like ability to move your hand without actually moving your hand. I don't know. Just play like Baroque for the rest of your life. Then you'll never have to learn vibrato.
That's what's so great. I'm doing the first suite right now, the Bach cello suite, and I'm like, I don't have to worry about vibrato right now. This is good. I can just play, and it sounds kind of right.
You're playing a Bach cello suite, and you just started playing cello?
Well, this is my third semester.
Oh. Okay.
I'm in my second year of my master's, so I think, wait. Yeah, because I did it my both semesters of my first year. So yeah, this is my third semester.
I'm not a cellist, so I don't, you know, that just sounds impressive that, you know, you're 18 months in or less than that, and you're looking at Bach. Like, that's, I don't know, that sounds impressive to me, so kudos to you.
Well, trust me, it doesn't sound impressive.
Okay, that's fair.
It's crunchier than a tuna roll, I don't know.
A tuna roll?
Like a crunchy tuna roll?
Yeah. I don't know. It was a bad reference. But, like, Dr. Murray's trying to get me to make, because I just, my bow speed gets a little too, it's too light and too fast. So it's very, it has been very wispy. And so he's trying to get me to, you know, use more pressure and less speed to get, like, a fuller sound. And so, like, right now he's like, I'd rather have you be crunchy, you know, but actually working on trying to get a fuller sound than have you be all wispy and not getting, you know, good sound. And so it's one of those, I'm trying not to be crunchy, but I'm being very crunchy.
The idea of like a crunchy tuna roll, I love that purpose now. for the record, I do love crunchy tuna rolls. So
I do too. Who doesn't love a crunchy tuna roll? I want sushi. Thanks, Michael.
I almost had sushi tonight. Oh.
Oh, you're going to make me go get some sushi tomorrow. I don't even know sushi around here. We're getting on a tangent here. For the record, the idea of weight with string bowing, that has helped my conducting tremendously.
Yeah?
Yeah. I never understood the idea of taking sound with you with, you know, Luke kept mentioning this idea of, like, wispy sound, like you just kind of lightly brushing your bow across the string without any effort, and it's not getting any substantial sound. And that idea has helped. I'm learning the same thing, so that has helped my conducting, because if you're wanting to drag the sound across, you know, you have to have that weight with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
go ahead.
I was going to say that my current teacher now, he actually has us go to the rec center and get in the pool and practice our conducting in the pool, especially for something like Brahms, something with a really heavy, thick sound.
I'm pretty sure, what's his name? Not Farman. He taught the younger, the like earlier class.
Eduardo.
I'm pretty sure Eduardo told several people at Bard the same thing while we were there that summer. Because the whole getting in the swimming pool thing wasn't new to me. I'd heard that before, and I'm pretty sure it was from Eduardo.
Yeah. I don't know if it... Does it work, Jeremy?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
He said... The big idea is that... So, I forget what it is. It's like resistance without tension, and string players can feel it in the bow because it's friction that's creating the sound of the instrument. But going into the pool and having to move your hand through the water is another way to just kind of get that feel of moving slowly and moving with a lot of weight to the sound, but without tensing your arms up.
That was one of the major comments that I got at Missouri, was that I am very tense. And I don't remember who of the two teachers that told me that, but they said that I was very expressive and clear, and that the ensemble could totally understand musically what I was asking for, but it was so tense, and that was actually affecting the sound. And I think that's worth I don't know. It's one of the hardest things that I've ever tried to accomplish so far in my personal conducting journey is accomplishing the slow, thick movement, but you're not tense. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know.
That's very hard to do, is be loose but not fast.
And also intense without intent, without tension.
Intense without tension.
It's not just moving slowly. It's moving like with this slow, really purposeful movement. And you have this energy and there's something behind it, but you have it very controlled. And finding a way to do that without actually tensing up, especially in the moments when you're conducting, is difficult. I find myself if I'm doing something really slow and tense, like my hands will start getting tingly halfway through because I'll realize that I'm like, I didn't even notice because I was focusing so much on the music.
Yeah, flexing everything.
Yeah.
But that's where I feel like coming, I'm not saying it fixes everything, but as, learning the cello, that's something that I feel it has helped a lot as far as conducting. There's so much tension involved, and with cello playing, I don't know if it's as much for violin, but you need to be able to do just that, get a strong intense sound without the tension, and I still struggle with it. We just talked about it at my lesson on Tuesday as far as how my shoulder gets so tense, and when my shoulder gets tense, my elbow gets tense, and everything gets tense, and then the sound is tense. And I feel like that kind of plays right over into conducting as well, because if you're all tense, obviously you're gonna hurt and get sore and be miserable and crap out after 30 minutes. But it might also affect the sound that you get from your ensemble.
Your band director, Dr. Zestapil, mentioned something that is going to stick with me. There's a big difference between tension and muscle. And you do have to not necessarily flex your muscles and be tense and tight, but, you can't be wispy either, to use that word in reference to your cello playing. You can't be light and frivolous with your motions. They still have to be deep and meaningful. And I haven't figured it out, but it was something that stuck with me. There's a difference between tension and muscle. Like, you can still use a lot of, slow, viscous movements without having tension.
Mm-hmm. In Le Bon, the movement tracking, I haven't gotten very much into it, just what we've done in conducting, but the difference between light gestures and heavy gestures was that heavy gestures take advantage of gravity, and you're using the weight of gravity. You're not pushing, but you're using that, and then light gestures are fighting against gravity. So I think what Maestro had us do, I think it was when we were doing Beethoven 5, he put a book on a stand, and we had to let our arm drop and push the stand down as far as we could, just by letting our arm go and taking advantage of that weight and that gravity.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. I was actually playing with that today, literally today in my practice session. I was experimenting with, so you have your shoulders and you tense them up and you bring them to your ear and then you drop them. You let gravity drop your shoulders. And that place where you end up, where your shoulders are as relaxed as possible, if you put your arms in an L motion, posture, you have your arms kind of there, and with your shoulders all the way down, that's home base, that's rest position. I've been trying to experiment with where is the ictus, where's the click? Of course you can choose wherever it goes, it's up to you, but there's a place, I think there's a sweet spot where it feels comfortable on your own body. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, the place where the ictus is going to be, like, you actually have to feel it. Like, feel like it belongs there to your body. And I think that's when you're the most relaxed and your shoulders are down. And if you want, especially if you want to get, like, a big, heavy sound from a brass section, like, you might raise both of your arms and then drop them, and where they fall at the most comfortable, meaty, weighty, gravity place with your shoulders down and relaxed, I think that's what's comfortable for your body. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, like, my professor, he calls it the plane. Like, that's the plane. So, like, all of your gestures need to come down to the plane, and that's where the beat always happens.
And it's different for everybody.
Yeah, yeah, and that's in reference to, like, the horizontal plane. Like, that is where you always want to try to be. And so, like, you know, something I've noticed in some of my conducting is I have a tendency to drop below my natural plane because I conduct relatively low already, just out of habit. And so something that we're trying to work on is raising, you know, my plane to where it's comfortable for me, but also so that it's more visible to the ensemble, because right now it's just too low. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And, you know, Farberman tells me to raise my plane too, and which goes against what I just said in this Skype meeting, because I like where you have your shoulders down all the way and you bend your arms and you feel the most relaxed and the most comfortable, that's where I would want to put the plane. But he wants me, and some other directors, you know, they might make the argument that you want to raise your arms so that the whole ensemble can see it, which is all good and well. Like, I'm not trying to argue any of my teachers, but what I'm noticing is that gives my body a lot of tension from the get-go without even having started the music. So it's something that I'm really trying to experiment with personally, because I think everybody needs to discover that place, that special place for themselves. Like, because only you will have your body, you know?
Yeah.
So let me back up here just for the sake of this Skype session. For the Missouri State Clinic, there was a lot of repertoire that was available, but the two pieces that I chose were Howard Hanson's. If you don't know Howard Hanson, anyone listening to this needs to go look him up, because he's a fantastic composer, orchestral and wind, American composer, and I think he is one of the quintessential sounds of the American classical music sound. Anyway, side tangent. Howard Hanson's Chorale and Alleluia for wind ensemble. And then for the second session, I did Shostakovich's Festive Overture, transcribed by Donald Hunsberger for wind ensemble. And the reason that I chose those two pieces is because the Chorale and Alleluia is mostly slow. I mean, it's in the name. It's a chorale, and then it's an alleluia, so it goes slow and fast. But, you know, I chose it because most of it is this slow lyrical music. And, of course, everybody knows Festive Overture. It's fast and furious the entire time. I did it because I wanted a change of repertoire style. And it was mostly in the it was in both pieces that I was told I was tense, but mostly in the Chorale and Alleluia, where I have to, it starts off with this amazing, beautiful brass chorale, and it's slow, and it's thick, and it's luscious and beautiful, and golden brass, and you cannot be tense when you're conducting that at all. But the problem is it's so slow and gooey, and you don't want to move too fast because you don't want, like, I mean, you don't want the tempo to escape you. You don't want your conducting to be – you want to make sure that the brass has the sound. Like, they can look at you to get the kind of sound that you want. But everything that we're talking about right now is what makes it so difficult to conduct like that, you know?
Yeah.
Because yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, like, you know, you mentioned, like, having the brass be able to look up and see what kind of sound you want, you know, and that's something that I struggle with a lot because one of my teacher's favorite things to say is gesture equals sound. My gesture should equal the sound that I'm wanting to get from them, and which is a lot harder than you would think.
Oh, yeah. All three of us, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Gesture equal. I mean, that's what conducting is. I mean, conducting is you are the music. Your gestures are the music. So what's the point if you're going to be conducting something that doesn't even look like the sound that you're trying to get?
One, two, three, four.
Exactly. Which I think is a great segue. You had asked me to talk a little bit about what it's like studying with Farberman. And I mean, if it's okay, do you want me to move on?
Yeah, that's fine.
That
is, in a nutshell, that is studying with Farberman. As you two know from the summer, but it's Farberman is all about two things. Let me be careful trying to sum him up here, but number one, I mean, his whole phrase about music makes technique, I mean, he talks about that every single lesson, and what that may mean for any listener that doesn't know is that music, you know, a lot of people learn that the physical body motions of conducting, the technique, you know, the floor, wall, ceiling, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, or, you know, this is a staccato, this is a legato, and then you learn all the tools and that's conducting, and that's fine, I mean, because I'm not so stingy like some other purists, quote-unquote, like, it's okay, like, beginner conductors need to learn that stuff, but Farberman's point is that when you look at the music and you study the score, I mean, it's any given part of the music is what your body needs to be reflecting. And his whole point with that is that you can be creative as to what your body can do. Anything and everything to be able to accomplish the sound that the composer is looking for. So that's one thing. Music makes technique. Your body is the music. Your body is the sound. And the other thing is, and I mean, I don't think any conductors going to argue that, by the way. Like, that's not revolutionary. That's not new. That's not absurd. That's what conducting is. And the other thing, which also is not revolutionary, is everything is about conviction. I mean, if you don't have your ideas, your own ideas, and you don't defend your own statements, then what's the point of you being the conductor? I mean, some conductors talk about how the composer is the epitome. I mean, the composer wrote it and you are the servant to the composer. Well, yes, that is true. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, if you composed it, that's a whole different story. But if you're conducting Shostakovich, then you're going to represent Shostakovich's music. But there's something to be said, something magical about the idea that you are conducting right now. I mean, it's your interpretation of Shostakovich's music, and there's only going to be that one connection on planet Earth. I mean, whether you have Luke's interpretation of Shostakovich or Jeremy's interpretation of Shostakovich, I mean, this is what makes it magical. And then you have the third element, which is the ensemble. I mean, Luke could be conducting Missouri, but then he could be conducting the Bard ensemble. You know, it's like it's the ensemble and the conductor and the composer. And so Farberman tells us, don't be afraid to make bold statements and defend them, and even if people don't like it, like, at least one of the biggest like, if someone will say to you, I don't like what you did with the music, that's in some way one of the biggest compliments, because that meant you had an original idea versus the whole idea of Farberman says, like, the worst thing is when someone says, like, I can't even critique your music because it doesn't sound original. Does that make sense? Farberman wants us to steer clear of the recording, quote unquote. Like don't conduct like the last recording we heard. Like, make it yours. And, you know, if you want that retard there, make it yours. If you want that diminuendo there that's not written, make it yours. Now, at the same time, read up on the composers and don't do anything stupid. Like, don't do something that the composer wouldn't do, clearly. But sometimes, like, if you do enough study and you do it enough, if you let the music take you along, sometimes there's these really magical moments that you need to prepare that, like, when done from your own brain, like, and it's your idea, then someone else may have had the same idea, so to speak, but it's going to sound different because it's coming from you, and no one else can replicate that if it is truly and genuinely your idea. And that's Fagerman's whole spiel, in a nutshell, is like, discover yourself, study the music for yourself, don't practice with recordings, and when you are up on the podium, I mean, stand your ground, even if the orchestra doesn't like it, if you're clear and convincing, the orchestra's going to play it. And that's like the highest honor for a conductor versus someone who thinks they're conducting just by doing a four pattern, but they have no idea what they actually want with the music. And by the way, it's taken me coming here to school to learn that about Fagerman, because when I was there for the summer program, I was just too scared to even gather that. Like, I don't think Jeremy was scared, but Luke and I were scared.
Oh, I was terrified. Don't worry.
You never seemed it. But anyway, I mean, it's like I was always so scared of getting up on the podium and just messing up.
Mm-hmm.
You both know what I'm talking about. Like,
yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. I felt like there was a right way to do something, and I had to figure that out.
Yeah, and there was exactly, and there was the infamous clap, the four claps. Like, Fagerman stopping us, you know? And I was always just dreading that moment. By the way, we still get that on a weekly basis. But it's not so scary anymore, because once you figure out that what Fagerman really wants is for us to have our own idea, things get a lot easier after that. Because He tells it like it is, just because, I mean, why hold back? That's his whole theory. The only reason why it was scary during the summer is because there was a whole orchestra in front of us and 30 conductors behind us, and it was humiliating. But, like, it's a lot easier. He does the same thing, but it's a lot easier when there's only a pianist and two of your colleagues, and there's, like, five of you in the room, and that's it, you know?
Yeah.
And then...
Your time is maybe not as limited. You have more experimentation and a longer relationship.
Compared to the 15 minutes that we would get every day, I have an hour. I have 2 hours a week with him.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's brilliant. It's amazing. And he really provides this platform. The platform wasn't really provided in the summer because we didn't have that much time. But he really provides a platform of, this is a safe space for you to litter the floor with mistakes and think and try and ask questions and make sure that your idea is your own. And he'll tell me things like, did you like what you got? Did you like what you heard? And I mean, half the time, honestly, I have no idea if I liked what I heard or not. I'm just waiting for him to tell me either good job or you suck. And he's not interested in stuff like that, because he'll just say, like, were you actually listening to what you just conducted? And I mean, of course I was listening, but it's hard to, like, you think it's a trick question. Like, I guess I should say no, because otherwise he wouldn't ask the question. But he's really asking you, honestly, did you like what you heard? And so then I'll say no, and of course he'll say, why not? And then I'm stuck there, because I don't know why I didn't like what I heard, but something about it was I didn't like it. And he said, well, try again and try something different. And his whole point is he just doesn't care about the four pattern. He doesn't care about the fact that Berlioz put, you know, Allegro Vivace in that spot. He doesn't he doesn't care that 20 conductors in the past previous recordings all did it this way. Like, he wants you to come to that decision from your own journey. And if you happen to be the 21st conductor to get there, at least it was because you decided that it was valid and not just because everyone else did it. And yeah. I think that's one of the biggest problems in conductors of our generation is that, I mean, we have Spotify, we have YouTube, we have recordings of the Wazoo, we have this overwhelming, looming sense of dread that everyone is trying for all the jobs, and so we're scared of that. And it's just this overwhelming idea that I will never be original. And that's just the biggest lie. That's not true. Because no one else is Michael Patterson. And, like, it is a fundamental fact that no one else will be me. And so I am original just by existing. And so are the both of you. And so that's what Farberman is trying to drag out of us, even though it seems so counterproductive because over the summer, it seemed like he was asking us to do it one way. But that's why he stopped us every single time, was because the very nature that everyone in that room thought that he was trying to get us to do it his way, everyone was wrong. Because he was trying to... But then begs to ask the question, why didn't he just tell us straightforward, like, do it your own way? Because he wants it to be your own journey. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that has proven to be the best reason why I came here to study with Fireman, because he's teaching me the roundabout way of conducting to be myself, not how to do a four pattern, you know? And, like, I think that's the thing that a lot of conductors need to learn to live with. Not all, I say a lot. What I mean is all. All conductors need to learn to figure out who we are, why we make the decisions that we do, and then stand our ground. And if someone says, like, why did you do that? Then you actually have a reason to tell them and not just, well, I don't know why I did that. I just did it, you know?
The worst answer of, like, that's how it's always done.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That, exactly. That's how it's always done. Well, who decided that was the way it was going to be, you know? And why can't I decide today that I'm going to do it differently?
Yeah, I mean, it's so much more, you know, clean cut, especially with, like, modern composers who are still living, you know, because you can have the composer's actual input as far as, like, you know, what we, you know, we have recordings of these composers, if they aren't conducting their own work, they were probably involved with the work being recorded. But, you know, when you come in early Romantic, classical, Baroque, we have no idea, you know, it's all stuff that's kind of been passed on. So there's so open for interpretation as far as, like, how you want to do it. Especially as the further back you go, and there's editors' markings and all this stuff that you have to start looking past the score too, and, like, you know, what in the score is actually what Beethoven wrote versus what an editor put in here, you know?
Right. And the next question is, why did the editor put that there? And I think that's the important question, is, was the reason because it actually improved things? So here's something that I'm learning right now, talking about this whole string thing, is Erica and I, part of our lessons with violin playing is learning how to bow music, which as a conductor is crucial, even though the concertmaster is probably going to be the one doing it, but, you know, you need to know the kind of sound that you want and how to get it with the bow and all that. And it's just a mind-blowing experience for me because I didn't know – like, Jeremy, I give you also kudos because I didn't know how much bowing makes a difference. I mean, there's only two directions you can go, but apparently it makes all the difference.
Like, but there are only 12 notes in the scale. 11.
Touché.
On the keyboard.
And so, you know, going back to the idea of the editor's markings – I think it's so fascinating that 9 times out of 10, if a composer puts a certain type of articulation or bowing, the violinist will change it. Yep. 9 times out of 10. They'll just do something completely different that will accomplish the sound the composer was going for better than the composer intended. It's like, I don't understand it. I'm also not a string player, but I don't understand it. And so the editorial markings, what I'm learning is like, you know, did that actually improve the marking of the initial intent of the composer? And I mean, the point of all my jargon is just to say these are all things to think about. Use the noggin. Think. Determine. Research. Don't just do something because it sounds pretty and feels pretty. And I'm the number one person. I speak for myself when I say that I used to do that all the time. You know, is, oh, I mean, I'm just going to take this crescendo because it feels right. Well, that's baloney. You know? Even Bernstein himself, the most emotional conductor on earth. I mean, he made logical decisions. Not everything was just an impulsive, like, well, the music feels good right here, you know? So anyway, I'm going in all sorts of tangents.
So when you and Erica work, have you talked about the, I think Elizabeth Green wrote a book on orchestral bowings?
Oh, I have that book.
I haven't read it, but I've been given handouts from it, and I don't know how good it is.
So isn't Elizabeth Green a big band person?
I've known of some of her conducting books with Niccolò Malco.
Okay, I take it back. I think the reason why I say that is because I've only ever heard of her books from band conductors. But you're okay. Right. I don't know much about Elizabeth Green. But I have heard of her conducting technique books, and I've also heard of the bowing, but I've never read it. Should I?
Okay. I don't know. I've never read it either.
Okay. Well,
I'm not sure how much of bowing can be, because I feel like at least when I'm bowing parts, a lot of it's just like kind of what feels best, while still achieving the same effect.
Right. Right. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, half of it is going to be as it comes anyway.
Yeah.
But, well, I don't know. It's worth looking into.
Mm-hmm.
You guys had mentioned at one point in time that you wanted me to talk about how I study the score, because I'm looking at the time of the session. I don't know how long your sessions usually are.
Usually until they putter out. We don't enforce any time constraints.
Okay. Well, at any rate, I hear Luke yawning over there.
I'm sorry. I get up so early.
It's very late for Luke right now.
My bedtime is like 2 hours ago, but it's okay.
Well, and I mean, I know I'm not boring. It's okay. I'm just kidding.
I would love to hear about your study, and especially if it's changed working with Farberman.
Oh yeah.
Oh. Is that even a question? 100%. Oh, my gosh. How do I score study? Okay, so while I was at Missouri State, I loved what Dr. Zastapil told me on the podium when I was conducting. So the format of how it worked out was that we got to conduct twice, and for each session we got one of the two clinicians, and then they would switch for the second. And so my second session was the Shostakovich Festive Overture with Dr. Zastapil. And so what he ended up telling me was he felt like I knew the music really well, and I had done my studies like a good pupil, But I didn't look genuine. Those are not his words, but that's what I interpreted. And I kind of understand what he's saying. It's like, I did all the motions, but I did all the motions because I was supposed to do all the motions, and I didn't look genuine. I didn't feel like the music was in my heart. And what he told me was that you need to live with the music for a lot longer. Just kind of settle with it, live with it, understand the music. And I know exactly what he's talking about, is that when I'm score studying, it's very difficult to conduct a new piece, even if I can prove to the whole orchestra that I learned it in a week and, you know, all this good stuff, whatever. I mean, that's nonsense if the music isn't in you. And so what I'm trying to learn right now is how to study in a way that's effective in internalizing the music. So in essence, it's kind of like memorizing the music. I hesitate to use the word memorize because I don't memorize on purpose, but I don't remember who said this. I think this was Bernstein. Nope, Simon Rattle. Sir Simon Rattle said, two very different people, but two genius conductors, both of them. Sir Simon Rattle said, don't try to memorize the music. Just live with it and sing it. That's a big one, is sing it. When you're alone and you don't have to hear it, and no one has to hear your hideous voice. I speak for myself anyway. I'm sure both of you have lovely voices.
We've heard all about Luke's beautiful voice.
Oh, man. Now, you study in the comfort of your own home when nobody's home, and you sing the parts out loud, and you get to know the music, and then all of a sudden you'll find yourself one day conducting a rehearsal that you forgot to turn 10 pages, and then you have to kind of catch up and then find yourself. And that's when you know you've memorized it, and the better word is internalized it, because you didn't need the music. Because you know it, you have it, you are it. And that's how I'm focusing on score studying now. I start off by finding out the instrumentation, and then I start doing all the measure numbers, and then I do the phrasing markings, and I have my red colored pencil and my blue colored pencil and my regular pencil and my ruler, and I draw all the lines and I do all that stuff. And that's for the first, you know, 2, 3, 4, 10 studies of the score. And I'm marking all the cues and all that good stuff. But I mean, after a while, you kind of put away the pencils and the ruler. And what I find myself doing now, no one taught me this. This is just what I've kind of settled doing. Is I go about the score alone, and I sing. I only have one voice. So I sing the most important thing, with the understanding that everything else is going on too. But it's like I can only choose one thing to sing. And that's how I decide what's important. With the consideration that that can be changed at any given time, you know? You can prove, someone can prove you're wrong, or you can prove yourself wrong that, like, I think I want to bring this out instead. But it's a great place to start learning the music. What I used to do score studying, well, first of all, the gravest mistake I ever made was studying with a recording playing. And it did help me because it would help me, like, as I'm watching the music following along and the recording is going, I would hear, like, it's kind of like visual and audible learning, where you would, you know, you hear the horns and you see the horns, and now it's kind of like, oh, there's the horn entrance, and then you can mark it with your pencil, and then, like, oh, now it's the strings, and now it's the woodwinds. And that would help me, but the problem with that is that you don't internalize it if you're studying it with the recording. It's just that you're hearing the yummy goodness of someone else's production, and you can't create that way. That's the problem. And so I stopped that. I threw that out the window, and it wasn't necessarily far Farberman that told me to stop studying with recordings, but he doesn't need to tell me that. I've been yelled at him enough to figure that out on my own. Ever since I came to Bard, what he has helped me realize is that all the information, first of all the information is there in the score. Everything you need to know. Articulations, dynamics, phrasings, notation, instrumentation, structural analysis. I mean, it's all there in front of you. So you don't need someone else's recording to help you, because what you need, first and foremost, above everything, is your own brain. You just need to figure it out. And the longer you spend time with it, alone, you and the score, that's going to be your own work and your own effort. And so what has helped me is not only singing, but playing it at the piano. It helps because I am a pianist. And that's how I end up interpreting my score, is when I'm sitting there at the piano, that's how I kind of decide what I'm going to bring out, how I'm going to phrase things, how fast, how slow I'm going to go. Obviously, keeping the tempo marking in mind, but at the same time, tempo marking doesn't automatically equate to feel. It's just a number. I'm spitting out a lot of jargon. to summarize it, what I used to do was focus on time signatures and patterns and cues. That's what I used to focus on. Like, if I'm conducting a four pattern and if I cue the horns now, I'm doing conducting right. And that's like all I thought conducting used to be. And of course, dynamics, extra credit for dynamics. If I'm conducting small, I'm obviously doing piano. If I'm conducting big, I'm obviously doing forte. Like, that's conducting. And, you know, needless to say, I was very wrong. And I'm still a young conductor, and so I'm still learning, but what I have learned so far, what I do now, ever since I've met Farberman and my previous conducting teachers too, is the big question is why. Like, everything from all the cues and dynamics and phrase markings and instrumentation and all that stuff that you need to do, that's all pre-study. Like, that's not even, like, at this point in time, that's not even considered. Like, I think you have to do all that stuff before you can start studying the score. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, you break down the phrase markings, you figure out the instrumentation, you write in all the cues, dynamics, feel, expression markings. Now I can start studying the score. Because what studying is it's the decision making. It's, why am I bringing in the horns here? Not because they've been resting for 50 measures. They're going to truly appreciate me if I cue them in after 50 measures. But sometimes there's going to be a time when I can't cue the brass who's been counting for 50 measures, which, by the way, all brass members are champions at counting. Like, they appreciate the cues and the looks, don't get me wrong, but, like, I have not yet come across a professional or almost professional brass section that if I don't cue them, like, they don't come in. They still come in. Mm-hmm. So what does that prove? That proves to me that they don't need you. It's just, if you want to be a good and nice guy, you should probably give them the cue. But what I'm trying to get at is that sometimes there's going to be a time when you can't cue them, because you need to be with a different section, because that's what the music is all about. It's just that coincidentally, many times, when you cue in the brass section that has been resting for 100 measures, it's because they're important. Like, the fact that they're entering now, the fact that the composer has left them out for 100 measures, and now they're coming in, is most likely because it's for a musical effect. And so that's something that Farberman has really told me, is there's a difference between a cue and an entrance, is you might want to consider the reason why, not you might, you need to consider the reason why you cue somebody, because that's what the music is asking for.
Yeah, one of the things that I thought was probably the most fascinating aspect of the conducting workshop this past weekend was how they would, he would go up and he would have the conductor not do anything, but just stand there. And then he would give a downbeat, they would start playing, and then they would just play. And he'd just let them play for a while, and then he stopped them, and then he would tell whoever was on the podium, that is their musical base. That is what their basic musicianship will get you. Obviously, in order to play the piece, they did not need him or need the conductor. However, at that point, it becomes our job to the whole thing with it. The pattern isn't important. You're there to show them something that they cannot do themselves. They can play the piece themselves. They need you to bring the ideas and show them how to do your ideas. I thought that was just absolutely fascinating.
Right. That's why we as conductors exist, is because we've been given this responsibility that it's our idea of the music that counts right now. And mind you, what I just said sounds extremely egotistical, because it's not about us. And we know this, but in case any listener is getting confused, it's a beautiful marriage between the conductor and the ensemble. They have brains, they have hearts, they have musical instinct, and we can't make music without them. And so it's their, like, Farberman has kind of taught me that it's a beautiful thing when you choose to let the musicians play on their own accord, so that when you choose to come in and intervene, it's because a musical choice has to be made right now, and they need you. That's something I'm really learning, and that's something I haven't gotten, I haven't mastered it yet, because it's complex, it's philosophical. When do you decide when a group of people need you and don't need you, and how come it's your decision to decide when they need you and don't need you? That's complicated stuff. And my biggest problem as a conductor is that I overconduct. I'm tense, I'm big, and I am overbearing. I conduct everything always. And what I've been learning from Farberman and from this past weekend at MSU is, and I mean, it's not just in the last 8 weeks. I mean, we're talking for years. I've been hearing this is, don't conduct everything always. Let the orchestra or the band play and take charge when it's really needed.
Yeah.
And that's one of the most difficult things for me to wrap my mind around, because you think it's easy sounding, but it really isn't. It takes a lot of decision making. So, yeah, I mean, to be continued on that. That's how I score study is to me, score study is a really personal process. When I say personal, I mean intricate. I mean profound. It's oftentimes underestimated. Score study is about getting to know the music that the composer wrote on a level as if it's like when something gets stuck in your head and you can't stop singing it. Like that to me is considered score study. When you know a piece, like you know every part, not as if you can show off to people, like, I know that this part comes here and I know the second clarinet plays in measure 57, the C sharp, you know, it, not that. I'm talking like you can't help. Like when someone else starts humming that tune of a piece that you love and you jump in because you love it and you know it and you just can't help but sing along, like that's when you know the music.
Yeah.
And basically, Farberman is telling me that in order to get to that point, you have to spend a lot of time with the music and you have to make a lot of musical decisions. Like, how do I want to phrase this? Why do I want to phrase it this way? And which direction are we going? And so it's something that's very decisive, very intricate, and very personal. And if any conductor doesn't take that much responsibility with their score study process, then they're not taking it seriously. Because when you get in front of the ensemble to actually conduct, the music needs to be a part of you. And if it's not, that's, I think you're doing a disservice. So that, you know, at the risk of talking too much, that's that's where I am now. Does that help you at all?
Yeah. And I really like one of the first points you said was, I think the rattle quote, that you shouldn't memorize anything on purpose, but it should just, that should just happen. And just spending that much time with the score and getting to know it, not with the purpose of memorizing everything and not with the purpose of learning every little intricate thing by rote, but that you learn it by spending time with it.
Well, and I think Michael will understand this as a pianist because we have to memorize everything. But when you try to memorize something, I find it so difficult. But when you just sit back and just learn from it, and yeah, just spend time with it, all of a sudden you've memorized it and you didn't even have to try.
Right.
You know, I'm working on the Franz Strauss Horn Concerto right now in my lessons, and one of my end goals was to, you know, memorize it at some point. And I, the other day I realized, oh my God, I have half of this memorized and I haven't even tried, because it's just working, making the effort on something, you know, spending time with it, listening to it, and I don't know, just living with it for a while. It happens. I think if you try to force it, you just make it more difficult.
Agreed. I couldn't agree more. And that's exactly what I'm talking about, is that, you know, that's how you live with it. Now, there's one last thing I should point out here, is that that's really hard to do as a conductor, because you're freaking dealing with everybody's part on a, it, I mean, with you have a violin piece or a horn piece, it's a couple pages, and for a symphony, for a conductor, it's a book. You know, like, it's everybody's part is there. How are you supposed to memorize everything? And it's such a difficult, painstaking, long, not a, unglamorous, is that a word, process. And, you know, and this is why it's respectable for conductors to know the music. It's because you know for a fact that they have spent time with it. They've looked at every page. They've understood. And I mean, look, one more thing to be said here is that once you conduct Beethoven's Fifth, that's not going to be the only time you conduct it in your life. You're gonna look back. They're gonna look at it. I've done Beethoven's Fifth so many times at this point. I've never actually performed it live, but I've done it for countless auditions, countless lab sessions when I'm in school, and it just keeps popping up again. And so at this point in time, I don't need to study Beethoven's Fifth anymore at the level of, oh no, how does measure 17 go? Because at this point in time, I know it. Now, of course I still study it before I conduct it again. I'm conducting it in a month again for homework. Because when you study, you want to make sure that you're always finding something new every single time. And it's an ongoing process. But it'll get easier because of the natural effect of time. You're just spending time with something. You're living with something. So it gets internalized. And, yeah. You know, that's just the name of the game. And like it or not, that's what we have to do. So anyway, do you have any other questions?
I don't. We covered quite a lot.
Yeah, I know.
And very well. Very well. You had a lot of good information there, Michael. A lot of good way to think of things.
Well, It's just from my own personal experience. And half the time I have no idea what the heck is going on. I feel like we're all just walking through the dark together, and we're here for each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I hope what I said is helpful.
Of course.
Well, thank you.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going
to Michael.
Sorry, Michael, you're the guest. You first.
How long have you guys been doing this? Is it a podcast? What's the nature of this program? Do you guys do this weekly?
We do every other Monday.
Every other Monday? That's still very impressive. Good job, guys. This is cool.
We're glad you could be a part of it. I was so excited when Luke messaged me and said that you were in Springfield.
Oh,
and then suggested that we talk with you.
Springfield has some of the nicest people I've ever met. And I only say that because I've gone from L.A. to New York. And I feel like if any city slicker that goes to the Midwest just meets the nicest people. And it may be a different story for you that have lived there your whole life, but I don't want to know because, to me, they were very nice.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Podium Time. You can find show notes for this episode and all of our other episodes at podiumtimepod.wordpress.com. Be sure to join our mailing list there or on our Facebook page at facebook.com/podiumtimepod. Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony was performed by the Czech National Symphony Orchestra, and Beethoven's Egmont Overture was performed by Stefano Ligorati.